know. Again, he's in Philadelphia. He's performing at the Bijou tonight and tomorrow night. This is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. It's now 2 minutes after 4 o'clock. The music that you hear on commercial radio represents only a small percentage of the music that's produced by record companies. For every record that gets airplay and becomes a hit, there's tens of records that never even make it onto the radio at all. Joining me in the studio is a man who's very influential in deciding which records make it onto the radio. My guest is Cal Redman, who says that he gets goosebumps and that his hair stands straight up when he hears a record with hit potential. He spends hours and hours each week listening to all the new 45s that have come out. His remaining hours are spent as the editor and publisher of the Friday Morning Quarterback, in which he writes his evaluations of what records will become hits. Radio stations around the country find out what he thinks by subscribing to the Friday Morning Quarterback. It seems like it's a big money operation. Rolling Stone estimated recently that Cal Redman grosses over $1 million a year. He publishes the Friday Morning Quarterback from his offices in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. But before getting into this end of the music business, Cal Redman worked as a DJ at WCAM in Camden. And he was also the head of a special education department in a Philadelphia suburban school. Cal Redman, I'm really glad you could make it here, particularly in the light of the lack of gasoline, etc. So welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, and it's my pleasure to be here.
Let me ask you, you spend so much of your time trying to guess what's going to become a hit and what can really make it on the radio. How come you're doing that and not the radio stations? Why should they need you? Why doesn't every radio programmer on every FM and AM station, or at least every music director of that station, sit down and listen to the records themselves and think for themselves about it?
Well, in the minds of many, they do. And in the case of others, if they could, they would. Number one, you have to get a little bit scientific and practical about it. A person who is selected as program director of a radio station, his orientation very often is in the engineering aspects, in sound technology, in production of commercials, in radio production, in putting together an overall sound of the station and evaluating its disc jockeys. Where is it written on tablets of stone brought from the summit of Mount Sinai that encompassed in this very same person is the ability to evaluate aesthetically and commercially the vast amount of music.
But we're talking about disc jockeys, not engineers, and not
we're talking,
record producers.
Yeah, you've used the term disc jockey, so we'll draw a line of demarcation right there. Years ago, it was the individual disc jockey on each show who programmed his own show, with the predictable chaos that resulted in all the other things that we read about now in history and see in some films. It is the program director, sometimes delegated to a music director, MD, who does the selection of the music that goes on the radio. The individual disc jockey in today's radio, be it album rock radio, AOR as it's sometimes called for short, or be it top 40, be it adult contemporary, whatever the musical idiom or format of the radio station is, it is the program director that makes the decision. The disc jockey has virtually nothing to do with it.
You think
so that eliminates only if you want to survive and only if the station wants to avoid Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Yeah, then it's good.
Okay.
If that's not a problem and if it's a tax write-off, then do it the other way.
Now, I thought radio stations made hits. And from what you're saying, it sounds like you think that radio stations have to go by what's going to be a hit, and that, you know, that there's, you as an expert have to help them decide what's going to be a hit.
Yes, I as an expert have to help them. They have a million things to do, and the management of most and owners of most radio stations are very enlightened people, and they usually demand about 23 and a half hours work out of their people, out of a 24-hour day. You being in radio, I think, know about that. So I would say on Monday morning, when they have the luxury of going to the lavatory in the morning, they get about 5 minutes time out of everything else they have to do to make that decision. So we present our two publications, the Friday Morning Quarterback album report, edited by Bill Hard, our resident genius on that subject, and our top 40 report, and they read our front red page and make their decisions in the 3 or 4 minutes that they have, and then they can spend the rest of their day helping the owner to make money.
How do you listen to records?
All the time. We're listening all the time.
What are you listening for?
It is not the term hit is a simplistic term, as it is understood by the man or woman in the street. The term hit in professional terms, in radio programming, radio broadcasting, is an entirely different animal, as is true in many other technical fields. The word hit is a demographic or psychographic term. We are interested in target audiences. With the explosion of the FM dial to this very radio station, which has opened up an entire new spectrum of radio stations, where the FM dial is now, in many cities, overshadowing the giant 50,000-watt AM radio stations, just as network radio, when television came in, was overshadowed by the independent radio stations back in the early 50s. There are so many radio stations competing for the same audience that you have to select your target audience based on age group, which has a concomitant of the purchasing power of that audience, because the whole thing, except for this radio station, is involved in the selling of commercial time, a la newspapers, a la magazines, print media, and it's a bottom line situation. So you pick your poison, you go after your target audience, and so what a hit means to me is different kinds of hits. I'm interested in one kind of hit that will deliver males 25 to 54. I'm interested in another record that will deliver males 18 to 24, 18 to 35. Arbitron, which is the rating service for radio stations, the spring rating numbers are just coming out now. They break down the results. Not only age 12 plus, which has become a meaningless overall rating, but by these cells of demographics / psychographics.
So you listen to each record with all these different categories in mind, deciding if the record has a chance of being successful in any of those categories. And I imagine you deal with radio stations whose audiences are very diverse, radio stations that fit into each of these.
I would give the comparison with my friend and neighbor Carmichael of the Eagles and Dave Cash, second baseman of Montreal. You go to watch the Eagles play and you see him breaking for a pass and you think of a two-hand touch game. As he tells me, he has 75 different factors in his mind when he has to go for the ball. And the same thing there's my analogy. I have 75 different factors in mind when I'm listening to a radio. That comes from a lifetime of experience.
Could you say off the top of your head some of the traits that might distinguish a hit for the 18 to 25 audience from a hit from the 25 to 45-year-old audience?
Well, 18 to 25 male or 18 to 25 female or 18 to 25 neuter.
Let's go start with male, 18 to 25.
Well, male 18 to 24 would naturally obviously go for hard rock. You go to the Spectrum and see 20,000 males at the Grateful Dead blathering and banana brained. Many of them go for hard rock. It also becomes a function very often of IQ. Shakespeare wrote at many different levels. The guys from K&A in Fishtown have an entirely, very often, entirely different interest in music than the gang from Swarthmore College, obviously. And radio has to reach the tastes of all of these people. Females, the prime demographic target would be females 25 to 35, because there are two words that are the buzzwords or functional words, and that is, who controls, Terry, the discretionary income? Who controls the money? Who makes the purchases? The same situation exists in television, of course. So,
isn't it also a kind of stereotype of what the sexes are like to say that men buy more records than women? I've always heard that tossed around.
men buy more records than women.
We're not into the buying of records, really,
at this point. That is one of the concomitants of how you do your research, which I know you wanted to talk about. But no, there are no stereotypes. The tastes of men, as in many other things, vary widely very often from the tastes of female. Men very often hate Barry Manilow. Barry Manilow is the greatest male pop star of all time. If you want to use the a criterion of sales, at $14.95 for his albums, he has five albums that have exceeded sales of 3 million. And by sales alone, he is the greatest selling male pop star in the history of recorded music at this time, to give you a statistic.
What's his age group? Who's he appealing to?
Right now, Barry Manilow, his age group right now appears to be 11 to death for females. If she's still warm, she's still good and still interested.
So the demographics, okay, the 18 to 24 male is listening to hard rock. The female is listening to, you say, Barry Manilow.
Very often.
And,
no, I'm not saying,
who?
I'm not.
Who
joking.
Else? Uh-huh.
Females?
Uh-huh.
Well, what are females interested in? They're, many females are in the business of romance and love and getting married or having a relationship and having children and all the things that go with it. And that has to be accompanied by music. Music makes it happen very often. It's the catalyst of a romantic relationship.
I see feminism is not really entering into your analyses of what's going to sell and what's not going to sell.
Well, feminism...
I mean, maybe you don't consider it at all significant.
No, feminism is fine, but... It's all part of it, but let me put it this way. Let's get back. Let's localize it. Let's focus in at concerts at the Spectrum. If you sit and talk with Larry Magic Maggid, the concert promoter par excellence of the entire United States, let alone Philadelphia, when they have a Grateful Dead concert, the crowd that comes to buy the tickets. A general characteristic of them would be, in many cases, kind of spaced, angry, hostile, want to fight, mad, in many cases, lower IQ. Then the Beach Boys come. You know, you can't introduce spring and summer into Philadelphia without the annual concert by the Beach Boys at the Spectrum. And that crowd is generally clean, clear-eyed, bright-eyed, happy, cheerful, smiling, laughing, kind of a Rorschach test of via music. So every crowd has its own, and everybody's has a right to be entertained. Years ago, when radio was a lot simpler and music was a lot simpler, everybody had to listen to the few songs that were around.
So we're talking now about the younger audience, 18 to 24. Mm-hmm. What are some of the characteristics that you distinguish, that you think distinguish people, men and women, age, say, 25 to, where does that go, to 35, 40, 45?
To 54.
To 54.
WIP's ratings, we just got the demographic breakdown. They're pretty heavily skewed now, 45 to 64. Of course, KYW All News and WWDB, two-way talk radio, would also show a preponderance. The advertisers are less interested in age 50-plus audience. Obviously, somebody about 35, especially in Philadelphia, they're on their second wife, second car, second house, and they need everything, all new furniture, and they've got money to spend, and they've got to spend it, so that's the audience that you want.
But I thought you said they wanted women.
Well, women...
Because if they have their second wife, they are probably male.
Well, it depends. If you're advertising financial services and so on, there are a lot of things that executives... How about the airlines who... they would appeal to male very often, not even 25-plus, but 35-plus, the traveling business executive. It's really very simple and very logical. You don't have to be a rocket scientist, Terry, to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of music do you think is appealing to this age group? What kind of records are going to work?
Females or males?
Let me talk about males.
The hardest audience to deliver, to get to telephone, or let's get practical here, to telephone a radio station, request a record, is to get a male, 35 plus, or even 25 plus, to call a radio station and ask for a record, to find that piece of music is tough. The example that I use very often in a number of magazine interviews that have been done on me is Gordon Lightfoot, Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And when that record came out, in speaking with radio programmers are looking not to play records. They're looking for negatives, for reasons not to play them. 300 come out a week, maybe they're going to play two or three. They said to me, gee, that could be a hit for cities that are near the Great Lakes. You know, the subject matter was about the ore ship that went down based on a true story. And then I found it was becoming a hit in markets hundreds of miles away from any body of water. So I tried to ascertain why this was becoming a hit in general and why, as I soon saw, was becoming a hit with males 35 plus. Remember, music is not sent out there in a vacuum. Your audience that listens to a lot of your jazz pieces, there's a whole lifestyle, of disco, lifestyle of hard rock. Why was it, why this record? It's a biological laboratory. You have to get into the sociology of the situation. Well, let's examine the male. The average male has either almost died himself or has a friend that either died or almost died in something involving water, boating, swimming accidents, whatever. The fear of the sea, the fear of the storm, Joseph Conrad, you go into everything involving that. Men get goosebumps when they hear this record. It has a chilling effect. It brings up deep emotional experiences going back into their past. So this a piece of music of this type becomes extremely important. And that's why you hear it all the time to this very day, even though it's now a number of years old. And Gordon Lightfoot, in writing it, both in the music and his famous folk pop narrative style of singing, which he has, just a tremendous situation there. So that becomes an important piece of music. Does that explain something?
Right, now musically we could describe it as a folk-oriented ballad?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And that kind of thing works well with an older audience.
Yeah, right now you have Charlie Daniels record out there, and The Devil Went to Georgia. Now, I put it on the front red page of the Friday Morning Quarterback that this would become a hit coast to coast. Now, The Devil Went to Georgia, immediately from the title, Charlie Daniels is a boogie rock southern band. He's not known for having hit top 40 singles. "Quote unquote," he's a well-known album artist, etc. And people were shocked that I said, "Hey, forget about this just being Georgia. This is going to be localized." Because when we're little, mommy tell me a story. Well, we never outgrow that. We love stories, soap operas on the radio or on television. So I said from the beginning, I recognized immediately that The Devil Went to Georgia, and I saw a couple of elements here. If you remember the Tallahatchie Bridge story, and there have been a number of records like that. Taxi is another one that they play forever here on Philadelphia Radio.
What works for women, do you think, in that age?
What works for women? Well, there are many different, obviously, kinds of things that work for women, but if you want to get quintessential, you go right to Barry Manilow. And Barry Manilow says it all for a lot of women. I brought a record with me that if Barry Manilow were to record it. It's being played on a couple of the adult FM stations in Philadelphia. I believe US1 is playing it, and I don't know if Magic is playing it, which is targeted adult contemporary, what we call mellow rock, soft rock. And the word rock is a contradiction in terms. This particular song, if it were done by Barry Manilow, would be a hit. But it's done by the man who, by a man who hasn't had many hits, and because it's him and his image, it's now apparent it isn't going to be a hit.
Who are you referring to?
The Dobie Gray record, which I brought, called "Who's Loving You."
Do we have that ready to go? Okay, why don't we hear that in a few minutes? Sure. What I'd like to do, we'll hear that in a few minutes. What I'd like to do is get a sense of how you listen to things when they're new, when they're just coming out, and when you want to. Evaluate if they have the potential to be a hit or not. Maybe we can listen to a Nick Lowe record, someone who happens to be performing in Philadelphia tonight with a group called Rock Pile.
They're opening for Blondie and Deborah Harry at the Tower Theater tonight.
Now, he is someone who our listeners may also know as the person who produced Elvis Costello's records.
A very brilliant man from England, And there's a whole generic situation here. You talk about new wave. This is a new music from England, which our album editor, Bill Hard, focused on first for the entire country and Canada. And there is a whole, I don't want to use the word wave, a whole new burst of creative energy from this marvelous island, the British Isles. Bram Tchaikovsky, I brought the record by Sniff and the Tears, the Nick Lowe, of course Elvis Costello, who has less mass appeal. But this whole new burst, new music from England, is right now on the verge of capturing the imagination of the American radio listening audience.
Kyle Rudman, why don't we do this? Why don't we listen to a bit of this Nick Lowe record? It's a new record called Cruel to Be Kind. And then I'd like to ask you, after we've listened to a bit of it, how you would evaluate it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is Nick Lowe. Listening to a new Nick Lowe record called Cruel to Be Kind. It's a 45. Cal Rudman, what are you thinking as you listen to this?
I'm thinking mass appeal, mass audience. I hear a melodic flow. You can, you like the beat, I give it a 98. Dick Clark used to do it in these studios for many years, as I used to watch in front of my black and white television set. And that's a long way from Elvis Costello, isn't it? About whom you've been talking. It's nice, pleasant, inoffensive music that if you were in the car, most people wouldn't hit the button. Certainly females wouldn't. So you have a male image artist, Nick Lowe, with a piece of music that isn't going to offend women. And that's the best of all. He's got that album rock image by being associated with Costello and what he's done himself. But by the same token, he's got what we've been used to getting from England over the years. Paul McCartney-type, simple-minded, airy, pleasant music. And you're touching all bases, mass appeal. It's wonderful.
Having just listened to this briefly in passing here, I think I hear an irony in it. You've got to be cruel to be kind. Is there irony in it, do you think?
Yeah,
and
well...
What does that do to the sales of a record?
Since the folk people... Yeah, not to step in your words here, but since the folk people stepped into popular music, obviously statements are made, and it came out with the Vietnam War, and the lyrics are important, and people are very much lyric contest conscious. And in terms of the single is the magic sesame. It's rubbing Aladdin's magic lamp to the entire album. The Switchboard Susan is a cut in this album, and of course the album rock stations are playing a number of cuts. In fact, this cut is probably a little too pop for a number of the AOR or album rock stations, though they're going to have to play it. But they would prefer to play other cuts that have a little more pith to them and a little more meat.
Okay, let's hear another one. Get your reactions to it. This is a group called Sniff and the Tears, a group who you say is also from England.
Also England, right.
This is what, a brand new record called Drive
Brand
to
New
See?
Record, a fabulous album. It's on, Nick Lowe, incidentally, is on Columbia Records. We should state that. And, the Sniff and the Tears is on Atlantic Records, and this is a tremendous song, and let's see if you can
hear
familiar elements in this song that you've heard in recent hits.
Okay, let's hear it. Yeah, that's by a group called Sniffin' the Tears, a new tune called Driver's Seat. You obviously think that's going to really make it.
Boy, ain't it?
Why? Why is it going to be a hit?
Because it's a license to steal. It's a license to print money. It's got it all. We just talked about while it was on. Who does it remind you of, Terry? Immediately, what is it? What artist that's currently...
Well, the opening guitar really reminded me of George Harrison from around 1970. Mm-hmm. Then you mentioned Jerry Rafferty, which I really have to agree with. Mm-hmm. It sounds vaguely like other things I've heard. I can't really put my finger on what. I can't say I really like it. I mean, I could recognize qualities in it and qualities that I could say might be hit qualities.
Well, remember how you feel about it, Terry, on first
listen. It has nothing to do with what's going to become a hit, sure.
There are impressions made on your autonomic nervous system, your central nervous system. In addition to your cerebral hemispheres and right brain and left brain dominance, and
I also figure that what makes an impression on my brain or what my brain makes an impression on might not have any correlation with.
In other words, if you liked it, we'd really worry about it, right, Terry?
No. I mean, there's some hits that I really love, and there's some hits that, like when I'm in the car with the radio on, I'll just like reach for the button. Try something else very quickly.
Which takes us to your next question of how do I listen to a record and how do you listen to a record or how does anybody? And I'm like anybody else, I modestly admit, in how I deal with a record. The metamorphosis and evolution and development of a quote-unquote hit record is as unique as a human fingerprint. No two situations are alike completely. So sometimes I will feel a record isn't there in the beginning, but then it goes out and gets played, and as it develops around the country, I'll monitor the situation, and my opinion might change. As I get to hear it more often, I may hate a record in the beginning and get to love it, as happens to you. Very often, fortunately for me, I'm able to hear them right off the turntable. Sometimes the first 15 or 20 seconds, I know positively or I know negatively. Every situation is different. So, and that happens to a lot of people.
How many times do you listen to something before writing about it in the Friday Morning Quarterback?
That's just what I just said. Okay. Every situation is different.
Okay, let's try another record. This is Robert Palmer, who's had a number of albums. I guess he hasn't had
He had one half a hit. Top 40 Radio would love to have a hit by Robert Palmer. Why? Image. Robert Palmer is a superstar image. People love Robert Palmer. He's the artist they love to love. So if they could get a mass appeal hit, I didn't finish my other sentence before about Nick Lowe and Robert Palmer. When you get the hit single, the single is the greatest advertisement, and in terms of the business itself, promotional tool for selling the album where the money is for the record companies. But I'm talking about meeting the needs of the radio programmers, which very often are not the same. But it opens up the entire artist's work. That's why it's important to have a hit single. They can pander to the popular taste with a hit single, a la what Billy Joel did with some sappy love song, Just the Way I Love You, and then it opens up his true art and his true creativity. And once a creative artist realizes, hey, go for the top 40 hit, Elvis Costello has to learn this, and that's great. You get the hit, and then they'll listen to your album, and they'll get to know every song. And the only price you have to pay is, again, as I said, the metaphor, Aladdin's Magic Lamp, Open Sesame. Give them the hit single, and then all things become available.
Well, let's listen to another tune. This is Robert Palmer, who we were mentioning, and it's a new song called Bad Case of Loving You.
Doctor, subtitled, right.
today we're listening to something by Robert Palmer, a tune called Bad Case of Loving You, Cal Rudman. Why do you think that works?
Well, if that doesn't get you up out of your chair to boogie, you got to be dead, Jack. It makes you move and groove, diddly bop, and shuck and jive, and glad to be alive, can I tell you? It jumps off the table and pops you right in the eye.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, because the kind of beat that has and that you think is going to really be absolutely contagious
probably,
when
it's probably
it gets on the
going
radio.
To be a number one record.
Uh-huh. Now, that's really different from the beat that's also selling millions and millions of disco records, and that's
right.
Keeping a lot of radio stations in a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that break down? Because everyone knows that disco is influencing music across the board.
Mm-hmm.
Jazz musicians are playing disco music now.
They're just trying to
Cab
eat.
Calloway has a disco hit. Well, a disco
eat.
Record. I don't
Cab
know if it's
wants
a hit.
To eat, too. He's
right.
Got a little hungry.
Okay, but you take the stuff that's on the white-oriented FM rock stations, and they're pretty much staying away from disco and are able to do that, it seems. What do you think?
Well, see, the word disco and rock are terms. People like to pigeonhole. It makes people comfortable.
Well, we know what a disco beat is.
It's all dance music, and then you get fusion. It's all fusion. So how do you explain Miss You by the Rolling Stones, or Son of Miss You called Do You Think I'm Sexy by Rod Stewart?
Right.
So you combine the two elements, and for the musicians in the studio and the violin players that come in to do some overdubbing, it's all one thing, and it's what's the difference between all of it and swing? See, I only recognize a continuum of music. There's nothing new in 40, 50 years. It's just music, and it's dance music, and it's just a different variation. People get bored. In radio, we call it burnout factor, and you've got to have changes and hooks and different little gimmicks. But what happens with disco and rock is a difference of lifestyle. Different length of hair, different dress, different kind of dancing, and then it all mixes in and it all evolves. Because as I said earlier in this program, Terry, you're dealing in a human biological laboratory, and it just all evolves. It's really all one putt.
It's an interesting question, a chicken and egg type question that we have here. How is a hit formed? Is a hit formed because the record catches on, or is a hit form because everybody who picks the hits picks it as being a hit? Consequently, it's played on the radio. Consequently, it gets the exposure.
Yeah.
People get the chance to react to it, and it's maybe a self-perpetuating cycle.
That's marvelous, Terry. I love the way you answered that question.
Okay.
You did it all. I couldn't add another word to what you said. Fantastic.
You think that's true?
Of course it's true.
Uh-huh.
What comes first, the chicken or the egg? I would like to take credit right now for most of the hits, except the very obvious ones. As a matter of fact, that's now become pretty much true. It's pretty much coming out of our office with our staff. My right-hand guy, Ray Milanese, a 32-year veteran. My wife, Lucille, who picked a couple of tremendous hits this past year. I Will Survive by Gloria Gaynor. And Anne Mary, You Needed Me, both of which came out of Philadelphia radio. And as the various journalists come to the office to interview me, they come in and they see you talked about feminism. Lucille allows me to keep my desk in her office. And the first question they ask is, Lucille, let's see, you picked You Needed Me and I Will Survive. What are you trying to tell all of us about your husband by picking hits with those two titles?
Let's listen to another of the records. This is another new one. And what's the story behind this? This is someone who you were mentioning before named Dobie Gray.
Okay, Dobie Gray. Dobie Gray is black, who sings pop, which means that he doesn't go the route of most black artists of getting started on black stations. A Johnny Mathis type singer. He's had some hits, been out there a lot of years, a very gifted singer. The writer of this song is Mark James, who wrote The Letter and all kinds of hits. So most of the B.J. Thomas, the producer, has produced records that have sold millions and millions and millions of copies. When I heard this record, I fell down, I had a soul attack, my hair stood at attention on the back of my neck. It is played to some extent, as I said earlier, on Philadelphia radio. However, it is not going to be a hit. It is, in my opinion, My qualitative differential diagnosis is that this absolutely is a hit song. But someday it will be recorded by another artist with a big name, with a big image, and it'll be a terrific hit. Barry Manilow has done some tunes that other artists had out that were unsuccessful. So that happens, and let your audience hear it and see how. Let's play Rate the Record and see how they evaluate it, see if they give it a 65 or a 95. It's called Who's Loving You? And I'll introduce it as a disc jockey. For those who are alone and not in twos, here's Dobie Gray, the chant those blues. Walk on, Dobie, and carry that torch with a blue, 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 blue flame. Could this be the story of your life?
Wondering tonight, who lays beside you and whose decisions guide you? Who's holding you so tight?
Listening to Dobie Gray, the song is Who's Loving You? If you're just joining us, my guest is Cal Rudman, and he is very influential in helping radio stations decide what to play on the radio. He picks hits and publishes his thinking about new records in something called the Friday Morning Quarterback, which many radio stations around the country subscribe to. Cal, you obviously think the record we were listening to, you were saying as it was on, it's a work of genius, or maybe genius.
Well,
you
near
were saying.
Genius.
Near genius.
Do you know what happened? I just got it. Did you see the telegram that just came in? Half your females out there just committed suicide, slashed their wrists, and fell on their scissors. It's a good thing you stopped the record in the middle. You'd have lost all, 90% of your women. It reminds them of someone they're trying to forget, Terry.
So you think women are going to buy that record? Well, you think it's not really
no,
going to be a
women,
hit.
No, I think women are going to listen to it and commit suicide, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Except the few that are lucky and everything's going well this week.
How do you like it? How do you as a person like
oh,
it?
Oh, I love it.
Uh-huh.
I just fell in love. It's a fantastic, fantastic melody with classical quality. You said something. What was your quote? I'll let you say it again about Gershwin in the 20s.
Oh, that Ira Gershwin wrote lyrics to a song. The song's called What Can You Say in a Love Song That's Never Been Said Before. I was talking about the just emotional experience of riding in the car when there's gas to the station every day with my hand on the radio dial listening to a little bit of everything. And every piece of music, more or less, is either about someone who's just fallen in love or someone who's just broken up with someone. And there's a new kind of love song, and that's the reunited type love song. There's really a number of them now where people have divorced or separated and they're back together again. But it really is emotionally exhausting to listen to all of them.
Well, the radio stations know what's really going on. There should be no other stories on the front page but different love affairs and how they're happening. Because there ain't nothing going on out there except love, baby.
Cal
That's
Rudman,
what's
you,
happening.
You mention the music business to anyone and they'll look at you and they'll say, it's a dirty business. The music business, it's a dirty business. What do you think? you know.
Is it a dirty business?
Yeah.
No, I think it's a beautiful, clean, marvelous, spiritual business. But it is a business.
No, okay. I mean, there's always an interesting conflict when you're talking about music because you have people who are very artistically committed to the music, who are, you know, really putting their lives into what they're playing. Then you have the money-making end of that, which is obviously in conflict with it because works of true genius aren't necessarily works that become hits.
Well, that's true of any art form. Why focus just on music? That's true of book publishing and art and murals and...
Well, the interesting thing about art, well, in visual arts, you don't really have the hit phenomenon because...
You don't? The hit phenomenon is everywhere.
No, but beauticians, it doesn't...
Beauticians, restaurants, neckties, dresses, the whole... Our entire society. Now, you've touched on an open nerve here. Is hit-oriented, or as they like to pronounce it in our industry, orientated. But everything is based on the hit. This is a hit show, Fresh Air. People that want something enlightening and edifying and educational will tune in here. They can't hear anything like what they're hearing on this program, especially this hour. So the hit is everywhere. Anyone that denies the hit and the commercial benefits that come with having a hit, whatever the scope of the hit is, it's fabulous. If you can get just the people with a good IQ who have intellectual curiosity and so on, there are enough of those people to give you the vast audience that I'm sure you enjoy, Terry. So every water seeks its own level.
Okay, let me backtrack a little bit. A hit is good for making money, right? A hit is good for selling records.
A hit is good for selling money.
Advertising time on the radio, because the more hits you play, the bigger the audience you have, the bigger audience you have, the more you could sell your time for in advertising dollars. But, again, in conflict with that, you know, there's songs that don't have this, you know, mass appeal hit value. They're not going to be noticed.
Well, that's what I do.
It's always difficult.
That's what I do for a living. What happens to those people? Well, there's me, and I'm the one that finds it. Gray's Elegy in a Country Churchyard. Many a rose is born to blush unseen. I illuminate the dark side of the moon, and I find these hidden artists and... these new artists that we played on this program today. We talked about the front red page. It's become mythical in our industry. It's dark red paper, and if it's on the front red page, they say it becomes a hit. I've just single-handedly revived Dionne Warwick's career, and the song is produced by Barry Manilow with a dramatic, powerful style for which he's become famous.
But the interesting thing to me here is that you're picking these things not necessarily on the basis of what you think is really fabulous music.
Terry, you're off on a tangent, and I've got to bring you right back. I am in the radio programming business.
Right.
Let us have
a sharp, focused
definition of terms. I service the radio broadcasting industry. If I were brought in by the Philadelphia Inquirer, by the Bulletin, and I work with some of the Bulletin writers, I work very often when they're doing stories with Matt Damsker, for example. I'm the top source for the Wall Street Journal anytime that they do a story involving the / music broadcast
industry. I understand. What I'm asking you is, do you ever feel just a little sad that almost all of America's music is tied, glued to business?
That's not true, what you said.
Nearly
all of it is not. No, there are other ways besides radio. And that's why I brought the Dobie Gray, because yes, I would, if I didn't feel sad about it, I wouldn't have brought that record and bled all over your table here and tears pouring out of my eyes that this could be lost. But there are many other, you mentioned disco. Disco music comes out of the clubs. It is not dependent on radio. Disco stations emerged because this music came out of the clubs. When you have 20,000 people for two nights in a row to see an artist at the Spectrum, they come out and they buy. So, no, the music industry, the $4 billion a year music industry, is not a total handmaiden and slave to the broadcast industry. There are many other ways, and audience will find artists, and there are cults, and there are albums that you never heard of that will sell 50 and 75,000 copies. There are imports that come in.
Do you, a while ago when we were talking and I asked you about disc jockeys not making their own musical decisions anymore, Because most disc jockeys don't have the freedom to do that anymore.
Now they're too busy being stars anyway. So.
Well, you implied that we're probably better off this way, because when they did make decisions, there was all this payola going on, which has become, you know, very well known now. But aren't there many forms of that now, but just at different levels? I mean, maybe you can't buy a disc jockey.
That always comes up in any discussion, and what you're really talking about is commercial bribery, and that's something you would talk about with an attorney. Here again, you're getting into the sociology of people and their motivations when they have to make, what I said earlier, differential diagnosis and qualitative judgments. How are people selected for roles? And I heard Fernando Lamas talking about the casting couch the other night on the Carson show. And again, how are decisions made? How does somebody get to be an announcer on this station? Who made a value judgment, for example, that you, Terry, are the one out of the hundreds of marvelous, bright, alert, vivacious, sparkling ladies out there that would give their right arm and cut off their hair to be able to get on there, and their mother would sit and listen to them, and that's my daughter out there. I mean, you can get into that with anything and anybody, and it has nothing to do with the field itself, be it cinema or be it television or books or movies. People have to make decisions, and it has to be made by experts.
I resent this comparison because... No, I mean, really, that's...
Comparison between what?
Well, if we're going to use a comparison, let's use one that works, because...
Use any comparison you want. I think
it works. Me and all the other people who applied for this job when it was available didn't hire, advertising agencies to print up thousands of dollars worth of advertising materials for us and call the program director who's doing the
hiring. That's my way to get a job.
You'd
be, a few jocks have hired skywriters and run.
Oh, we've gotten some pretty racy
things
here.
How about the guy in Trenton that locked himself in the studio and got on the front page in Inquirer? My buddy Bo.
They fired him, and then they hired him back because they realized it was such a great publicity event, right?
If you want to buy that story, that scenario has been played out at radio stations since... It's older than dirt, that story. The news director was just let go, and he claims it was all a fraud. So, hey, the guy's from Philadelphia, so I don't know about him.
Now, I've been reading things. I don't know if they're really using this or not, but it sounds like they're getting close. It's basically, I think, galvanic skin responses. Mm-hmm, they hook up your fingertips, I think it is, to some electronic sensor. Mm-hmm. You listen to music or watch a commercial or watch a movie, and this sensor measures how much you're sweating, and I think the more moisture there is, the more of a visceral response you're having. Mm-hmm. So the more you sweat, the more it measures, the more money they're going to invest in this in this product. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a good way of testing things, of pre-marketing things?
Well, I went to Penn and I pre-med, and I have a year in medical school at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathy, so I know a bit about physiology and all of that. And I don't have any galvanic skin response testing equipment in our office. And if that would work, that would be out there, and people would be doing it. And they've tried, and it hasn't worked. And no, it's not a valid situation. They use it on testing commercials, and it's used a lot in television and so on. But it has not been a successful, viable method of research. I'd like to make a basic point here, Terry. The average person out there, many people out there in Radioland, think they can pick hit records. And one of the cliches that you'll hear, and I'm sure you have heard it many times.
What is it?
I listened to the radio. Yeah, I listened to the radio and I heard this record, and I just knew the minute I heard that record that was going to be a hit. And I can pick the hits, and I've been at places where guys were working on their dissertation for their PhD in physics, and they'd really rather be on the review panel of Billboard magazine, which I was for about 3 years. And I know I could pick the hit records, and the person that can pick the hits can make a lot of money, and I know I was born with this tremendous gift. And I'd like to put that little myth to rest right now. Music on the radio has already been pre-selected by experts. I referred to that earlier. There are about 4,000 or 5,000 albums released each year, which range in production costs anywhere from 20, 30, 40, 50, 75. Now with the new Fleetwood Mac they've been working on a year, $1 million, $2 million, the cost of a major motion picture. So it's the great horn of plenty at one end, the big tuba, and the little trickle out at the other end. So that music that you hear on the radio has already been selected to be a hit. In addition, there are a lot of FM stations are programmed by syndicators. It's on tape, and the same program is sent all over the country, pre-selected, and also the wall-to-wall music stations, DVR, Wish. That music is all evaluated.
I had a bit of an argument with someone about whether radio was becoming more homogenous or not throughout the country. I was arguing that it is, and that there's people who go around from state to state consulting and suggesting what should be played on the radio, and that therefore a lot of people in, you know, Missouri, Buffalo, Philadelphia, and San Francisco are getting the same input, and same input which they're using in their decision-making. Consequently, music is getting more homogenous and less regional. What do you think?
Well, in Philadelphia...
They argued, by the way, that that wasn't the case.
Yeah, well, people don't know. It's that's true, and it's not true. Again, it's chicken and egg. The city of Denver and the city of Phoenix have about 60, 70 radio stations. See, here in Philadelphia, somehow way back when they handed out radio stations, we were left in the lurch. And for the fourth largest market in the United States, we have very few radio stations. And before the FM dial, we had virtually nothing. So owning a radio station in a Philadelphia market is really a license to steal. You have so many radio stations that you have a divergence, but you have so many stations to program that it becomes a lot cheaper for somebody to have somebody send in a professional tape already worked out. But where you have that many radio stations, there's a tremendous... You wouldn't want to see selectivity. You wouldn't want to live in England where it's the BBC and you get what they give you in Europe. Radio in the United States is just fantastic. And of course, when cable television finally hits, you're going to have 40 channels coming in. So you're going to have a tremendous selectivity of television one of these days.
But, okay, so we have a lot of different choices. We have a lot of different channels
sure
on each radio band. But
I didn't answer your question about
regionalism.
Yeah,
because it seems to me that we have the correlation in each of those cities so that, you know, there could be a new type of adult-oriented rock and roll, a new alternative on the radio, for instance, but that kind of station might exist in every city, and in every city they might be playing the same records on that one station.
We talked about radio programmers, and they have to know their market, and if they don't, they fail. You've seen WMMR here in Philadelphia, whose ratings became lower than a snake's belly here for a while. In fact, I don't want to say they were low in Arbitron for a while, but there was one Arbitron. I think they owed them one share. But now there's been a tremendous turnaround, and this new spring ARB that just came out, they went right to the top. You saw WYSP, which was the big album station for a long time with that Superstars format, which my associate Bill Hard was the first Superstars jock in this pioneer in that field, where they had a program director got a little sloppy, since gone, and it's been written about in the papers. Matt Danska wrote about it, and now they're coming back. They just brought in a new program director, and they've turned around. So you have to know your market. Detroit is rhythm and blues, black-oriented. They really don't like disco as much in Detroit or St. Louis. Houston is very country-oriented and a country-type record, such as Don't I Make My Brown Eyes Blue, or Kenny Rogers would cross over more quickly there. So yes, the program directors know their business, know their audience, know their field, and they do give the people of their market what they want. Let's give them credit for being professionals and knowing what they're doing, and they're not on civil service. You lose your rating as a PD, you got to get a U-Haul, pull your kids out of school, take your crying wife barefoot, pregnant, and hit the road. Looking for another job, and it's sad.
We only have about a minute left. Do you see any major things happening in music in the near future, trends that are going to start happening?
You
see anything?
You just saw it on this program.
Uh-huh.
The new music from England.
From England.
We just discovered it. The new music from England. Bram Tchaikovsky, Sniffin' the Tears, Nick Lowe. This is the new thing in album rock music. Flash in the Pan. There's a terrific Hey St. Peter, which is the old Easy Beats. And that's a two-year-old single, but they came out with their album. Symphonic rock, what the Moody Blues Music is a cycle, like anything else, and it all turns around and recycles and evolves, and there are mutations, and that's what makes it wonderful, Terry.
Well, Cal Redmond, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for inviting me, of course.
My guest has been Cal Redmond. He's the editor and publisher of the Friday Morning Quarterback. This is a publication in which he gives his evaluations of new 45s. The publication is sent to radio stations all over the country that subscribe to it. It's a publication that tries to pick the hits. Cal Redmond publishes this out of his office in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Well, that's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. Monday afternoon on Fresh Air at 2 o'clock, we'll be joined by Fred Miles, who is a local jazz impresario. He's also produced a number of records. He'll talk to us about some of his experiences Monday afternoon at 2. Judy Stein, Fresh Air's arts reviewer, will be with us at 3:30. I hope you can join us then. The technical director for this afternoon show has been Scott Williams and Joyce Lieberman. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Danny Miller, and my name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Have a really terrific weekend. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Susan Stamberg.
And I'm Bob Edwards with All Things Considered.
Situation. We can't go anywhere because, you know, it's too expensive for gas and no one wants to waste the money by just cruising around.
Yeah, there's no guys riding around to pick you up like, you know, the guys normally would pick you up and take you there. I mean, we used to come over to Jersey to get beer sometimes, they'd go for you, but you can't get anywhere now because nobody will pick you up. You have to take the bus.
The energy shortage is changing the way we live and work and play. More than that, it's changing the way we think about ourselves and our country. Psychologists say our personal frontiers are closing. Tonight on All Things Considered, a consideration of energy and the national psyche.
Also tonight, the Carter administration now admits we're in a recession. We'll find out what that means and ask who's hurt the most.
A sociologist says economic problems may be responsible for the rising crime rate. Stress is the problem. It also affects our health.
The Federal Aviation Administration lifts the order grounding all DC-10s.
Commentator Morton Kondracki doesn't care for the synthetic fuels program.
Half of Pennsylvania's gas stations close in protest of the federal allocation system.
And dips tonight on All Things Considered. First news from Craig Oliver.
The FAA has lifted the order which grounded all U.S.-owned DC-10 jets since June 6th. The planes were grounded after the May 25th crash of an American Airlines DC-10 in Chicago. 273 people died. Inspections of all DC-10s in this country revealed cracks in the pylons which attach the engine to the wing. Such a crack is believed to have caused the engine to fall off Flight 191. But today, the FAA said the planes are now safe to fly. NPR's Carolyn Craven has the story.
FAA Administrator Langhorne Bond said in a press conference today that he has confidence in the DC-10 and plans to fly them again. Bond lifted the grounding order today after what he called the most exhaustive investigation of an aircraft in airline history. As a result of the investigations, the FAA will now require frequent and intensive regular inspections of the plane to ensure that there are no more crashes such as the one of May 25th. In addition, McDonnell Douglas, manufacturer of the plane, is being asked to redesign the assembly connecting the engine to the plane and to install warning lights so that the pilots know if they have lost an engine. There was no such warning light on Flight 191. Most of the 138 U.S.-owned DC-10s will be back in the air within the week, ending the disruptions in airline traffic which have occurred as a result of their grounding. I'm Carolyn Craven in Washington.